repeating loop here for 1.8 megahertz. And it's, you know, you can see it's a person standing next to it. And it's for 160 meters, I think maybe a little bit of a squeeze to get into a shack, but if you can get it outside, if you can make it up, get it out and stick it in the backyard, as this lady is standing here and showing you, it will make for a, as Dick says, a very viable antenna for receiving 1.8 megahertz. Transmitting, that's another story. There's just going to be the problem. I know people say, well, what good is me listening to a band if I can't, you know, get on there and talk to somebody? And that's a problem. There is, I have, let me let it drop and I'll tell you some of my experience.
One of the things I want to know, Bill, is that antenna that that lady is holding in the backyard, what's your rough guess as to the number of dollars invested to build that antenna? I'll bet you it can be done for less than $20. What do you think?
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, she, it was built, actually she tells you here that it was built, the cross arms are bamboo. Bamboo cross arms are used to support the antenna. And the piece of wire going around is a piece of coax cable RG59. And the tuning capacitor is a salvage tuning capacitor from an old broadcast radio. Let's see, the it's paying, okay, approximately 0.1 wavelength. And the conductor length of the cable going around the outside of the loop is about 20 feet of cable. Translates to 0.037 wavelength, 1.8 megahertz. So that's basically the design of this antenna. The one I built for 80 meters does work quite well. It's a little bit more manageable, of course. And as far as getting on the band and transmitting, well, that's a whole other story, and I'll tell you my experience. Let me first turn back to Dickie, see if he wants to make any comments, and then I'll tell you about some experience I've had on 160.
Yeah, I've seen that picture of, I think it's Doug DeMore's wife, alongside of the 160-meter antenna. That's the slats of wood and the loop around it, and it's held up against the side of the house, and she's standing alongside of it. That's a particular design. Just for receiving purposes, it is my belief you could build a smaller design. The reason I say that is people, when they wanted to listen to that 150 kilohertz transmission, which is 10 times lower, again, in frequency, they did it with a multi-turn loop antenna that was resonated, and that antenna could be easily located on a small stand on top of a picnic table. So I think there are other designs that could be used for receiving only. It doesn't necessarily have to be that big, because when you're doing receiving, the efficiency of the antenna almost doesn't matter, because there's always Mother Nature's noise on that band. If you're only getting 1% efficiency of getting the signal, and you're getting 1% efficiency of receiving the noise, the signal-to-noise ratio can still be beautiful as long as it's above the noise figure of your particular receiver. And since the noise figure on that band is like a 40 or 50 decibel noise figure, it's hard to build a receiver that's that bad. So I think it's possible to build a smaller version of it just to get your feet wet if you want to do some receiving on that band. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
No doubt you'll be able to receive on it. The only thing I have found peculiar with 160, it whet my interest a few years ago, and I would casually try to tune around 160 using my 80-meter antenna. I didn't seem to hear the activity I thought was beyond that band, and so I sort of passed up on it until just before the winter set in, where the opportunity is now that I can put up a 160 antenna, a dipole for 160. It does take up, you know, a bit of real estate, as they say. And all of a sudden, I see a band came alive. It's amazing that I was using a 80-meter loop antenna, which was 272 feet of wire, and I was receiving on 160, but that's why I say there's something peculiar with this band. that for some reason you would think that I'd be receiving fairly well, but I'm surely going to tell you I hear a heck of a lot more, especially DX stations. They are, I will admit, many times not much above the noise level, but I could not really hear them, Dick, with the 80-meter loop. But with the 160-meter dipole, I surely do hear a lot more than I have previously that I was quite surprised over.
Now, there's a couple of factors going on there, Mel. Your 80-meter loop has certain polarization characteristics, certain directional characteristics. Your 160-meter dipole, although it may be at a similar altitude, is oriented differently. So it's got different polarization and different pattern. So to hear one better than the other, one could have a pattern that more frequently favors the direction where the guys are and the polarization where the guys are. One maybe is more of a Nevis antenna than the other. I'm not quite sure what all is going on. So one possible approach is that, yeah, your 160-meter dipole is more efficient. Well, that 80-meter dipole, you got to do a great big antenna tuning function to get that 80-meter loop onto 160 meters. In that particular case, you could be picking up a significant amount of feed line loss. So difference in pattern and difference in feed line loss, and it is my guess that you're using a lot of tuning capability of your antenna tuner when you force that 80-meter loop to work on 160. What do you think, Mel?
Just for receiving, I tried, you know, just taking off one lead of the loop and using it just as a piece of wire, you know, a long piece of wire and all. I wasn't really up to building myself another one of these indoor-type loops because, first of all, I'd never be able to move that around the shack, one for 160 meters. One for 80 meters is large enough, you know, to maneuver around in the shack. But I would assume, I have never tried it, you may be 100% correct that if you built that loop that you see in the handbook for 160 meters, that it may be a very viable antenna for receiving 160. I have not experienced that. I did not build that one. I can only tell you the one I made for 80 meters based on that same principle. I just cut it down for 80 meters. Works extremely well. So it's very possible that, like you say, that if you build that one for 160, you may have an extremely good receiving antenna for 160, over.
I think so. And everything I've read in Krause's book on this so-called infinitesimal dipole tells me that when you take a full wave, half-wave dipole on, say, 80 meters, 132 feet long, and squeeze it down to, let me pick a number, a dipole that is only 25 feet long instead of 132. If you can build a low enough loss impedance matching network, an antenna tuner, and locate it close enough to the antenna where the feed line loss is not significant, you will get the exact same gain and efficiency transmitting and receiving infinitesimal dipole. Can't lose more than 4/10 of a dB if you impedance match it in a lossless manner. It's going to be a wicked impedance, highly capacitive, and it's going to be very narrowband. The Q is going to be sky high. The antenna may only be 5 kilohertz wide at the 3 dB points, but you can tune it to your favorite frequency. And it's a very easy receiver response you'll get when you hear the noise on the band go up. You'll know when it's tuned to the right frequency. So I am convinced that that great big loop that's in that article in the antenna handbook can be squeezed down on 160 meters and get 95% of that performance as a receiving device. It doesn't have to be big based on what I know about the so-called infinitesimal dipole. It's time somebody go out and do it and write an article and take another picture of you standing alongside of a smaller version that as a receiving device does the job. I've seen articles of guys having a relatively small loop antenna to listen to 150 kilohertz. Maybe it's a multi-turn loop. Just as long as it resonates, that loop will do the job for receiving, in my opinion. Over to you, Mel, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I think you may be right that the receiving loop that they show you in the handbook may be a very excellent antenna for, as they say, getting your feet wet on 160. As far as getting on there to talk to somebody transmitting, well, I don't know of anything simple to do. One of the questions, in fact, here, what do you think about, also on the subject of 160, what do you think about linear loading, linear loaded short wire antenna for 160? Well, have you had a lot of experience with linear loaded short wire stick that you can speak about whether or not they'd be viable for 160? Over.
Direct experience of mine, almost no. Anecdotal experience by way of other guys that have done it, got 15 years ago signed in the TechNet, yes. There were a couple of guys located on 18th and 20th floor of apartment buildings where they had a balcony and a railing, and they would put up a very simple 20-meter half-wave antenna that was spirally wound and used as a counterpoise nothing but the metal railing of the balcony, the veranda that stuck out to the side of their apartment at the 18th and 20th floor of their particular apartment building, and had very good performance. So shrinking down antennas by spirally wounding, which is a kind of linear loading, has a very good history. The rubber duck antenna is a little bit of one of those. But people have built a spirally wound half-wave antenna on 20 meters, where a 20-meter full-size half-wave dipole is 32 feet long. And they squeeze that down into something like an 8-foot length on a piece of fiberglass tubing with wire wound around it and in a spiral manner, and resonated it and had a lot of success. So enough guys have signed into the TechNet years ago doing that, but I believe it really does take place, and they were getting some very nice reports. So it can be done, as I see it, Mel. Back to you, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. The only thing that I can think of, you know, with linear loading, you've got to really understand what takes place. And what begins, I guess, to suffer is the cue. And will you get any kind of appreciable bandwidth? Because I guess the cue is down to a point where it's going to be a very ticklish antenna. Or am I wrong, Dick? Because I think that's why a lot of manufacturers of antennas and all have stayed away in many cases from linear loaded antennas to any, you know, great deal. I mean, you haven't seen anything like pocket size 20-meter beams or whatever that they have never really pushed, you know, too many of these real compact antennas, because I think maybe that they also got scared off by the situation, what happens with the queue. Am I correct, over?
I think you are. Way back in 1947, I think it was, 47, 48, Mr. Chu and Mr. Wheeler independently wrote articles about how high the queue gets on an antenna when you shrink it down to a new, smaller volume. They rated the volume in wavelengths, cubic wavelengths, and the Chu-Wheeler criteria, as it's called today, tells you what's the minimum Q you're going to get. Tell me what is the cubic number of wavelengths of physical area that your antenna is occupying. So as you make the antenna smaller, the Q goes up, it becomes narrowband. That doesn't mean the efficiency goes down, it means it becomes narrowband. And when it's narrowband, you're going to want to tune it every time you QSY. But there are antennas that do that. That Isotron antenna is an 80-meter antenna that easily fits into the room with you if you're in an apartment, and it's got a great big tuning control on it. So you tell me which portion of the 80-meter band you want to be on, and you tune the control accordingly, and the antenna goes there. And there are people who think that's a rather successful antenna. So it's going to become narrowband as you make it smaller. That's the laws of physics. That doesn't stop the radiation efficiency from being adequate as a transmitter as well as a receiver. I'll bet you've seen that isotron, pictures of that isotron antenna. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
Yeah, Roger. Well, we, like I said, I had built a version of it for a friend some years ago. He wanted to get on 20 meters, which was a little easier to manage. And we did this together. We bought pipe, copper pipe, water pipe, and built ourselves a homebrew version of it. And he was having a good time with it. Lived in the city, had his little appendage, I call it, that stuck off his apartment. And basically, two people were crowded if they went out on this little thing. They called it a balcony, but a very, very small area. And he put out one out there, and yes, I know it was critical to tune it and everything, constantly tuning the thing in any appreciable amount, either way on the band, without touching it up and all, but it did work. It surely did work. Of course, maybe we also had a little better conditions at the time, and because he did combine that antenna with a QRP rig. You know, a lot of people are misunderstanding QRP, that because you're running QRP doesn't mean you have to run a QRP, a compromised antenna. In fact, if you are going to go QRP, a lot of new hams have mentioned that all to me, try to use the best antenna of all. Do not get involved with, you know, an antenna that you say is so very marginal, even with running 100 watts, it's marginal, you know, getting out with it. With QRP, you're really, you know, going to get very frustrated after a while, not ever, you know, making contact. So QRP does not mean that you have to compromise on an antenna. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, good old Norm, K2KEY, lived his whole life with QRP antennas, enjoyed it. It was his vision of a fishing with light line, if you know what I mean. There are people who like landing a great big fish with 8-pound test line and play them for a whole long period of time. To them, that's the sport. And QRP has a little bit of that characteristic. Also, one of the things that's hard to understand is that when the band conditions are right, a couple of watts of power will allow you, through that ionosphere, to work some ridiculous ranges as long as the person on the other end knows what signal to listen for, and he's listening for that weak Morse code in the noise, and Morse code gives you, in many cases, near the optimum threshold of sensitivity. Well, the new techniques, the computer-generated techniques, and all of a sudden I'm having trouble thinking of the Joe Taylor techniques, are beating that by a whole lot. He can have a signal that is 28 decibels below the noise of your receiver IF strip, and he can get 95% copy out of that with the WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor techniques. And if you Google those words, you'll find that the Reed-Solomon detection technique has a whole lot of things to offer when it comes to modern computer processing of weak signals. So there's other protocols that will give you weak signals, but until the Joe Taylor technique came along, per se, Morse code was the best you could do. And Norm highly enjoyed running never more than 5 watts of QRP with Morse code. And he and WB2ZIT, Lloyd Mills, claimed to be the inventor of lowercase Morse code. See, most of the Morse code you and I have ever used is uppercase when you write it down. And he invented something called lowercase Morse code. Of course, that's a little bit of a joke. It wasn't real, but he had a lot of fun with that. So QRP can get you a lot of DX. I don't know if anyone has ever worked DXCC with QRP, but I'll bet you they have. I just don't think they've done 5-band DXCC on QRP.
Repeater, timeout.
Maybe you would know more about that, Mel. I'll bet you there have been DXCC QRP, but not 5-band DXCC QRP. What do you think? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Oh, I really don't know, Dick. I'm not really that involved in QRP groups. there are really dedicated groups that this is their challenges. QRP, they built some nice little radios. In fact, the last meeting we had this past week of the County Radio Club, one of the members who was really involved in QRP brought down a number of these little radios that he put together. there's a number of these little kits that are out there. These were all kit radios. None of them were built from, just from scratch in other words, unpackaged or whatever. These were actual proven radios that they sell as kits. And my God, most of them are, really pocket-sized radios. And I know at times he has been on the air with it. He's told a number of contacts, and I don't know what his DXCC standing is with it, or maybe some of his friends, how far they've progressed. I would assume that if you're persistent enough and we get some real decent radio conditions, I would assume that it's possible. But you're going to have to be a very patient person, because the problem is when there is a rear DX station or expeditions on now, the pile-ups are enormous. So people that are running well, unless they're going to be there for a very long time, it's just unbelievable. The expedition that was in the last one, a few weeks ago, the K5D, that's the Chico Island, was immense pileup. I never heard anything like it. They wound up making approximately 100,000 contacts in about, 10 days, Dick, over.
Wow. That sounds to me like you've got a guy running the equipment, another guy sitting alongside of them doing logging, maybe with pencil and paper, or maybe with a computer. So that was a multi-person operation during those 10 days, I'll bet, wasn't it, Mel?
That was quite a group that they took down there, and a lot of equipment, because they went to this island that there is nothing on the island except a bird sanctuary. They finally got permission from the Department of Interior, the Parks Department, whoever has the control over that island. It's near Puerto Rico, I believe. And they knew that whatever they bring on that island, they have to remove. They got to, in any way disturb the ecology of the island. They took a lot of things with them, and like I said, they had to clean up and everything. They sure were real busy. I listened to the first few days. It was, I don't know how they dug any signals out of it. And of course, the only ones that did get through is the big antennas with running the full power. And I didn't even make an attempt the first few days to let things calm down a little bit. So it would be quite a kudo or an accomplishment to work them with QRP, Dick. There may have been some, but I think they must likely have some fantastic antennas to be able to accomplish that, over.
So it can be done, and that's a challenge. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio, QRP and DXing, 5-band DXing. It's just one of them. I get more pleasure out of the higher frequencies. You've discussed already earlier tonight, Mel, the fact that sometimes some pretty heated discussions with some nasty comments are occasionally made on controversial subjects on, say, for instance, 80 meters. If somebody gets on the subject of religion, for instance, or Morse code versus non-Morse code as a requirement for the license. As I move up in the frequency regions where more of the equipment becomes homebrew because you can't buy it, until very recently there were very little homebrew equipment on 10 gigahertz. And of the 50 or so people I've talked to on the 10 gigahertz band in 10 states, to my feeling, it's a higher class of human beings, guys who are a lot more friendly with each other. The camaraderie of people who have gotten to what they think is a frontier in the frequency region, where they built their own equipment, and now you're having a very sincere discussion of, I used such and such technique, I thought it was better than the so-and-so technique. And this is how it worked for me. And you're really picking each other's brains, comparing notes. As I go up the frequency region, people get friendlier and friendlier with each other. And it becomes a lot of fun to pick their brain as to how they did it. Of the 50 people I've talked to on that band, I think you could say there was 48 different solutions to establishing equipment on that particular band. So that's something to consider. And each time you go up in frequency, you think you're going to have just line of sight and have trouble getting out of your backyard. It was, to me, rather easy to talk to somebody 380 miles away, and I was using 200 milliwatts, and we were 30 or so dB out of each other's noise with single sideband. He was down at Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, 380 miles away from me, and I'm talking to him with a purely transistorized transmitter running 200 milliwatts into a 2-foot dish. That is QRP, QRP. You can do that on these upper microwave bands. Fun contact. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No doubt, this is K2KEY. Yes, the challenge is really, to really, like you say, get something working on those bands. And it's like I say, there's that many different modes, 26 different ham radio operators and all. The HF, I know there's a number of people on HF that are, don't even know, they don't even care that even what we're on right now, they don't even think about, 2 meters. Just that they are dyed-in-the-wool lovers of HF. There's a number of them that are strictly contesters. You never hear them on except when they have a contest. And boy, oh boy, they are phenomenal when it comes to the contest, that they are so dedicated that they literally live by the radio for 24 or 48 hours, depending on which contest. And I can say, when there's no contest, they're not around. And they have, a couple of them have some phenomenal antenna arrangements and antenna setups. I mean, it's a huge amount of money that they've invested in antennas. So, and it depends on what you like in ham radio and what you get involved with, but I don't like anyone to tell me that, one is better than the other, really. That someone told me, some of these dyed-in-the-wool HF operators and all told me that, these guys, like we're doing here, a lot of people are only basically using, Peters and all, that they're not real ham radio operators. They're just wasting their time. They can use their cell phones just as good. So, like I say, Dick, it's up to the individual. Go ahead.
I just realized we had a man sign in, November 2, X-ray Zulu Sierra. I wonder if we put him to sleep, if he's still there. I think he said he had a question. And I think I also heard Eric. But let me hear X-ray Zulu Sierra. Are you there, sir?
Making this repeater.
A little bit low in audio volume, but you're making the repeater, definitely. Go right ahead. November 2, X-ray Zulu Sierra. If you're there, go ahead. Was that you that asked, are you making this repeater?
Yeah, I'm actually in the basement. Just want to know if I'm making this yet.
Yeah, in the basement, you're making it reasonably well. A little bit noisy, and the audio is a little bit low, but from the basement, you're getting out, sir. And I think you said you did have a question. Are you X-ray Zulu Sierra?
Yeah, that's correct. And I did have a question. Hanging out and listening to the very interesting stuff. So if I continue with the conversation and come back to me later, that's fine. I just don't want to...
Okay. During that transmission, you did fade out twice for about a second or two at a time. So if you could operate from a slightly higher portion of the house, not the basement, or use a slightly different antenna or orientation of your handy talkie, if that's what you're using, that would be helpful. Because if you've got a question that's going to take a couple of sentences for you to express it to us, and if you're going to be dropping out every 5 seconds, it's going to make life a little bit difficult. Now, did I also hear Eric in there, KE2EJ? Was that you, Eric?
Negative, Dick.
Okay, was there another person who signed in? Apparently not. I'll go right ahead, Mel, and go to the next antenna question if you want to. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right. See, I think we sort of covered the antenna question. Oh, okay, here's a question. Another, I could say, another young person. I found at a recent flea market a piece of equipment had a lot of nice parts in it, but the meter is missing out of it. It says on it that it is a Booten hay bridge. What in the heck was this thing? This was a popular item one time. Dick, do you remember the Booten hay bridge? Over.
I think I don't. Was this kind of an impedance measuring device? I'm going to guess it was possibly an impedance measuring device. And I may not have ever used or seen one. Go ahead,
Mel. It basically was a Maxwell Wheatstone type of bridge. And that was very popular, you know, back, well, I guess maybe up to not too long ago. And it had a meter on it. The meter was a center, zero centimeter. And you adjusted the controls on this thing. Had a couple of controls, I think, if I remember correctly. And you adjusted it for a null on the meter. That would be your sensor reading. And you read off the dials, the impedance. I think they also had a way of you could read the Q at the same time, if I'm not mistaken, Dick. I believe that was the... what was called the, it was another version, well, I guess it was a Wheatstone bridge with a, just a, why did they call it a hay bridge? What's the difference between a Wheatstone, Maxwell Wheatstone bridge and a hay bridge? I'm trying to remember. You maybe you recall, over.
When you look in the book called Reference Data for Radio Engineers under the subject of Wheatstone Bridge, in that chapter, there are a very large number of kinds of bridge networks where the four arms are all made out of resistors. That's the conventional Wheatstone bridge. And then you can now make some of the arms inductors, some of them capacitors, some of them tuned networks. There's a large number of kinds of bridges. And what the bridge does is that got four corners to this thing, so to speak, and when there are certain relationships between the first and the third side of this four-sided thing versus the second and the fourth, you get a null of the signal detector that's across the center. You could say you inject a signal at the 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock position of this four-sided bridge network. Picture a diamond. Picture a diamond-shaped object where there's... four points to the diamond, and in between each point you've got a set of, you've got a component or a set of components that can be resistors, inductors, capacitors, series, parallel, whatever. So you've got four networks between the four corners. You've got one corner at 12 o'clock, another one at 6 o'clock, one at 9 o'clock, one at 3 o'clock. You've got this diamond-shaped object. And so you inject the signal at 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock, and you listen for the signal across the points at 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And so at certain relationships between the components on those four sides, you will get a null of the signal. And that null is very sharp and easy to detect, and it gives you a lot of information. Depending on how you set it up, you can measure precisely the resistance value, the reactance value, inductance or capacitance, the resonant frequency. So when you look up the word bridges, reference data for radio engineers, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'll bet you there's at least 12 different kinds of bridges in there. Wheatstone is one of them, and I think hay is another one of the other ones. Next time I've got my reference data for radio engineers in the shack, I'll open to that page and we'll look at some of the others. And I wrote a patent not too long ago about a different kind of bridge. In other words, I found a way of setting up a bridge, which is different than a
repeater. Time out.
I found a way of setting up a bridge that was different than all of the popular ones that were in that reference manual. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I remember they had a number of those, like you say, configurations. They used to sell instruments based on that principle, using this diamond shape, where depending on how it was set up with resistors or capacitors or whatever, that you could basically, I believe they all, whether they were the Wheatstone or Haybridge, they were all based on listening for or monitoring or basically all on listening for or I could say monitoring the meter was really for a null indication, correct? Over.
In almost all cases, you were looking for a null. And one of those bridges is the so-called noise bridge that's popular in ham radio circles. You can buy something called a noise bridge, which will allow you to measure the exact impedance, the resistor value, and the reactor value of your antenna at your favorite frequency. You use your receiver as the detecting device, and you tune the controls until the receiver S-meter goes to a minimum while you're injecting noise into the system. So it doesn't even require a signal generator. A simple noise generator is a source of signal, and the frequency you care about is where you tune the receiver, and you adjust the arms of the bridge until you get a null of the noise in your receiver at that frequency the receiver is tuned to, and now you can measure the exact impedance of your antenna at that frequency. I bet you've seen noise bridges, Mel Grant.
Of course, used them for many years. That basically was the way I did all my antenna work many years ago. Grid dip meters and voice bridges and things of that sort, of course. And the only thing is staying with this, Booten was a company that was manufacturing instruments. See, I think they were in business after maybe, oh my God, up to maybe the 60s. I know they had a very good business going during World War II. They made a lot of instruments for the military and everything, and I believe they continued on. The meter that's missing in there, that the person here has asked me about, may be a little hard to find a meter. It was a, I think if I'm not mistaken, it was something like, maybe a 100 microamp zero meter. In other words, it was the needle sat in the middle. We called it a zero. Got what they call those meters. Zero centimeter type meter. Not meter. Zero type centimeter. I believe was the type of meter that's used in that circuit. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
I think the answer is yes. Yes. And the 50 microamp or 100 microamp zero center type Dawson Bell meter movement is what was popular in that day. Nowadays, if you needed a 1 microamp meter movement, it doesn't exist. With a simple modern-day electronic circuit called operational amplifier, you wanted the electronic equivalent of a 1 microamp meter, which through your operational amplifier really fires up your 1 milliampere meter and makes it electronically act like a 1 microamp meter. That's easy. And that operational amplifier in a bubble pack at Radio Shack will cost you 37 cents, so to speak, and it'll run on a 1.5-volt flashlight battery. So to make a substitute for that very sensitive Dawson Bell movement meter, which may no longer be available, other than trying to restore it, this classic piece of instrumentation, a modern-day substitute would be relatively easy. And by the way, the Booten company, let me drop, became very popular for the so-called Model 80 signal generator, the great big black speckled finish cased signal generator. Very popular signal generator in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The Booten company still exists. Maybe they've reformed, and they now make instrumentation that is being used at the cell sites to measure the passive intermodulation distortion of the antennas that are at cell sites. So the Booten company, or the resurrection of that company with the exact same name, still exists today, and they're making a fine product that I have personally seen with my own eyes not very long ago, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
KC2QIQ.
There's a man who knows about it. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just real quickly, just from background in inductors, typically the Maxwell bridges and the Haight bridges are mainly for testing inductance and by virtue of null. So it has like a built-in signal generator, like an equivalent RC, and you're going to put in the unknown L. And basically by tuning for the null, you can look at the calibrated markings and determine the inductance, KC2, QIQ.
Sounds like you've used one of those instruments. Does it have a popular brand name, Glenn?
I have one that was given to me a long time ago, a Maxwell and a... these things look like they're from from like an original science museum or something, but I think they were used originally as reference standards, like Bureau standards type stuff, or things from old standards that were eventually made it into a Hamfest a long time ago, and I actually picked it up very inexpensively, but it's more of a piece of art, I think, these days than something I'd actually use over a regular like HP impedance analyzer.
And nowadays, everybody does everything with a vector network analyzer. But back to you, Mel. I bet you've used a Model 80 signal generator in your days. Boonton, you got it, Mel, KQIYW.
I hate to say it,
but
not one. No, I don't throw nothing away. I've got buried away a lot of instruments. Glenn just made me laugh because one of the signs of a great instrument from years ago. It had a beautiful black Bakelite panel, some very beautiful knobs on it, etched, you know, the numbers were all etched into the panel, and then it was whited. They put that white painting in, you know, etched in the paneling. And, of course, the whole instrument sat in a beautiful box, a wooden box with a cover on it that was polished, you know, some kind of a beautiful fish on it, like a piece of furniture. So it was, like you say, it was, look at those instruments. They all looked, you know, fantastic. They must work exceptionally well, Dick, because they sure were beautiful to look at, over.
KC2, QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
RCA, Dick, Record Company of America. I looked at the marking on the front of it.
Okay. I remember seeing some of these beautiful great big Dawson-Val meter movements made by the Weston Company. Very precise meters with calibration curves, and the meter movement itself was about 9 inches wide, 9 inches high, and a great big mahogany box with a nice cover and a calibration curve under the cover and so on, with various great big posts on the side where you could put shunts across the meter to change its sensitivity. A popular way of doing precision instruments 20 and 30 years ago. K2KEY, we've got 9.5 minutes left, Mel. K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. You make me laugh because I could show you a meter I have. It was used for classroom work. It's a VTVM, and it has, I guess if you want somebody, you know, if somebody I ever run into that has problem with their sight and they need large scale. The meter on it is 1 foot by 1 foot. It's a VTVM meter that was made for, well, I guess in classroom, you know, the instructor had it up front. And the VTVM is big. I mean, it's about, the box is about, oh, I'd say over a little over 2 feet wide, and maybe about 20 inches or so high, and the meter sits in the front, in the middle of the panel, like I say, the meter's like a foot by a foot, with a big sweeping hand on it, with lights in it. This was a vacuum, what we would call, I guess a lot of people don't know what I'm saying, but it was VTVM, actually stood for vacuum tube voltmeter. So, I guess I'm sure Dick, you are very familiar with a VTVM, over.
I'm down to my last two. V7A, Heathkit model, vacuum tube voltmeters, which, by the way, I think the Dawson-Val movement in that is, I think, 50 microamperes full scale. The nice thing about a vacuum tube voltmeter is the lowest scale is, I think, 0 to 3 volts. I think the highest scale is 0 to 1,000 volts. And it's also got a times one ohm scale all the way up to a times 10,000 or something like that ohm scale. You can measure 10 mega ohm resistors easily with it, and resistors all the way down to a fraction of an ohm. Vacuum tube voltmeter. As a voltmeter, it had an input impedance of 10 million ohms, 10 mega ohms. And I think it used a 12AU7 tube. It was a dual triode tube that did the actual voltage measurement, and the meter movement was a pair across the two plates of this dual triode tube, as I remember. A modern day digital voltmeter also has 10 mega ohm input impedance and very similar ohm scales and very similar voltage scales, AC and DC, and ohm scales, just that now it's all done with solid-state circuitry instead of a vacuum tube. So we've updated the method of amplification inside the box. The philosophy of operation of a 1940 vacuum tube voltmeter, Heathkit style, versus the modern digital voltmeter, the philosophy of operation is almost the same. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hi, Jeff, this is K2KEY. Well, I have one. Gee, I hate to part with it. A senior volt ohm, RCA senior volt ohm, they called it, and has that beautiful white scale, you know, all plastic front, beautiful looking meter, nice die cast cabinet casing, you know, with a handle, and yeah, I guess they used 12AU7 in there, but I guess 12AU7 would have been yesterday's up amplifier. Up today, that I could say the up amplifier that you go in the store, IC that for 79 cents, and basically here you are. So no doubt, just updating technology, but for some reason I use it every so when I'm fooling around with some old pieces, very nostalgia, and my Simpson 260 is still sitting on my bench. I still use that all the time, so I'm a throwback. Anyhow, but the last words on this the boot, if I remember correctly, it had some beautiful controls in it, the pot, and there were precision controls, very, very linear controls, so that they were the calibration was amazing for those days, that they could achieve the accuracy, because those pots, it was all up to those controls. They had to be linear across the whole scale. I don't think they varied more than about 3% from one end to the other. They were big controls, I remember, wire-wound controls, beautifully made. So if you happen to have this thing, and okay, I guess you're not going to have a heck of a lot of use for it. I don't know if you find a need for it, but I guess you could most likely find ways to how it works. All right, I haven't got anything else here right now. It's getting late, Dick, so I guess we've got to wrap it up. This is K2KEY back to K2RIW and TechNet.
Okay, this
is
go ahead, Joe.
And XZS.
And XZS. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
This is a non-technical question. It's basically aimed at K2RIW and K2KEY. It's just a curiosity question, actually. In your early days of working on electronics and TV sets, especially TV sets, how many times have each one of you ever touched the second anode voltage in a TV set?
I think you really mean the high voltage of the cathode ray tube. In many cases, it was a metal tube, and you made the mistake of touching it even though the set is turned off, and it's still got 10 kilovolts on it. Not a whole lot of current, not a whole lot of stored energy, but very uncomfortable to be zapped with it. Oh, that must have happened to me easily 15 or 20 times. How about you, Mel?
The worst one was, oh boy, when you had to do a service call on one of those RCAs that had that metal tube in there, because you're trying to reach under sometimes with the set on, and that metal tube over there had that second anode, was the whole metal tube over.
So you were coming in contact with the 20 kilovolts that was on the cathode ray tube while the set was turned on. Is that what you're saying, Mel? And tell me what that experience was like.
Anytime, sometimes you just had a service one, you had to make an adjustment or stick your hand in there while the set was on with a mirror, you know, looking at it with a mirror on one of the consoles. Do you remember that television, that RCA that had that 16 AP4 metal tube thing, over.
Yes, I remember it was a conical shaped, in other words, the back of the tube was red metal, conical shaped, and the cathode ray tube face itself was round, even though you only looked at the 4x3 aspect ratio picture painted onto that phosphor. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. It had the front came off because you had to clean them all the time because it attracted so much dust in there. But they had a front glass plate, of course. And I remember I had the four insulators in the corners. They had these insulators to hold that tube, you know, extended because that whole tube was alive, over.
Yep. Did you ever replace one of those and realign it?
Yes. I pulled out plenty of them and realigned it. And, of course, people don't know about, you can tell them all about sometimes, Dick, about playing with the ion trap, over.
Not that a whole lot. And when you were replacing cathode ray tubes, what percentage of the time were you putting in brand new ones? What percentage of the time were you putting in rebuilt ones? Over to you, Mel.
Well, you know, the rebuilt was a bargain, so people most of the time heard that you can get a rebuilt for, you know, half the price or whatever it was. But the guy who rebuilt them, Atlantic here, I know the guy real well, so I'd take the tube down there, pick it up, I'd drop it off like in the morning, come back at night, he'd have the tube ready for me. He did it very cheap because I used to supply him a lot of times. He used to say, if you get any duds, you know, any bad ones that we break up, bring me the tubes, because people come in here, what happened, broke the neck, or broke this, or broke the bell, you know, whatever, it's not a salvage tube, you need a tube, so I used to work out a deal with him, I'd get the tubes for next to nothing, Dick, over.
Well, we're going to be closed down in a minute or so. N2 X-ray Zulu Sierra. Bernie, I think it is. Go right ahead, Bernie.
Finally, after 3.5 hours, KQRIW, WH5HJB.
The number 2 X-ray Zulu Sierra. Robert is the name here, and I've been trying to get in for a while, but it's okay. Go ahead.
Recognized, and Robert, unfortunately, depending on what way you're getting in, machine has officially closed down, unless you're coming in on the 147.375 frequency. So I'm going to pass it over to Robert first, if he's able to get in, and then I'm going to turn it over to Kent and see what he's got to say. N2 X-ray Zulu Sierra, go ahead, Robert, K2LIW.
Yeah, I was listening since about 8 o'clock when the net started, and I was trying to get in. I got in a while ago, but then we listened to the mailbag and stuff like that. Yes, I am coming in on 147.37. I'm out all the way in the island. I tried on the RLP. It didn't go too well. But anyway, I had some questions about amplifiers and antennas, but I guess I'll catch you guys.
Why don't you ask one of your questions right now, Robert? Go right ahead.
Dipole. I had a dipole, and it's I made it for 20 meters, and I moved to a different place. Right now, I can only put it up. I can put it up. It's my own property or whatever, but doesn't work out anymore because it's center fed, and I was going to ask about off center fed. Basically, we'll be coming down straight to the shack, and I was wondering if any particular measurements or like that I need to worry about, or I just have to shift the center to the right side. In my case, that worked the same way. It's the same half wavelength, 20 meter dipole. Right now it's center fed with the lateral line. Just wondering if I can shift it to the right, bring it down the same way.
Let me ask you this, Robert. What is your motivation for feeding it off center? Just because it's physically more convenient? Or are you doing it for a broad banding technique or an impedance matching technique? First of all, so your dipole used to be center fed. You're about to off center feed it. What is your motivation for doing that, Robert?
Three letters, XYL.
Okay. It sounds to me like it's done for mechanical convenience. And the so-called Windham antenna is a pop.
Reflector 9126, link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
Quite possibly the Windham design is going to fulfill what you're looking for now that you know what to look for. And you can feed a dipole in lots of different places. There was an article in QEX magazine displaying how high the impedance goes. If you want a high impedance feed for the antenna, as you feed it more and more off to one side with the right kind of a bowling device, the impedance climbs to higher and higher numbers. And depending on what you're doing with the design, that's in some cases a desirable thing to do. One other thing worth considering, though, and Mel's been down this road a number of times, and that is people visiting your house, for the most part, never look up in the air. You may have heard me say a lot of times, of all the people that have ever visited you, you can ask them, while they're inside your house, what's the color of the shingles on the roof of your house, and they probably cannot answer that question. They've never looked at it. Once you realize that, you'll realize that the higher you put up in the air above your house, essentially no other human being will ever see it. They don't look up there to look at it. So, you may see the wire because you and I as ham radio operators look for it. The rest of the world doesn't look for it. So with that understanding, there are times where a number of kinds of wire antenna, you worry about the aesthetics. It may not matter. No one else may ever see it. Over to you, Robert, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
K2RIW at Exodus. I understand. The unfortunate part is that I don't have much of a height to go with. I got two trees that I can go in between, and I can literally fit the, 60-foot antenna. And as I said, the place I lived before, it was right down the center with the ladder line. Now, the other thing is, how important it is for that ladder line to come down basically perpendicular to the dipole. Is it very significant, or can it be in an angle, or... I don't remember the dimensions of the ladder line, but it's somewhat around 16 feet. I have a 64 feet each side of the dipole, but the ladder line, I think it's about 6. And I took it out of the ARRL book. And don't quote me for the dimensions, but I might be off a lot at this point, about 2 o'clock. But how important it is for that ladder line to come straight perpendicular down?
Very unimportant. You can bring that ladder line off at almost any crazy angle you want to, and it's going to have an extremely minor, slight change in the tuning characteristics of the antenna. You could almost bring the ladder line just a little bit off of parallel to the dipole itself, and it will work. Now, the ladder line lying almost parallel to the dipole, let's say off at a 10-degree angle from being parallel, it will add some extra capacitance to that side. And if you're willing to retune for that extra capacitance to bring it back up to frequency, it'll give you 95% of all the performance you had before. So Mother Nature is not that critical when it comes to at how much right angle the ladder line's got to be brought off. You've got a lot of freedom on that one, Robert. And is this antenna going to be put up at your, in Selden? Is your current QTH on Sandy Lane in Selden? Over to you, Robert.
Yes, that's correct. And if you look on Google, you'll see the house on the corner of, it's a corner house, and you'll see a couple of trees, one in the front, one in the back. And that's where it would be. And planning to go from the front tree to the back left tree. Well, if you're facing the house, to the right tree. But It will fit the dipole, but it won't be, you know, as I said, I have to offset it towards the front of the house. How much can I offset it? I don't know.